Triathlon Show 247. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Mark Pierce. Mark is a triathlon coach in the UK with a strong background in physiology and sports science, including having worked as the physiologist of the British Triathlon Olympic team from 2002 until 2010. He has been to two Olympics during that time, Athens 2004 and Beijing 2008, and he also went to the 2012 Olympics as a coach of one of the athletes. So he brings a wealth of experience from high-performance sports that he now applies to both professional and age group triathletes in his coaching practice. But before we get into the interview with Mark, big thanks to our sponsors. First, we have Precision Hydration that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Precision Hydration make electrolyte products that you can match to your individual sweat sodium concentration, and they make it easy for you. You can just take their free sweat test, click free hydration plan in the menu bar on the website, and it takes a few minutes to answer 10 questions and you'll get an estimate for what your sweat sodium content is. But beyond that, Precision Hydration are also really great at educating everybody about hydration, nutrition, and all sorts of things related to endurance sports. So be sure to check out their blog and their newsletter. There's a lot of great content there. They also have some YouTube videos, interviews with coaches and athletes. I was on there a month or two ago, and it's just lots of great content there to discover for you. High quality stuff. A lot of the posts are really long and detailed, and reference a lot of good science when it comes to things like hydration and nutrition. You can get 15% off your order with the promo code DATTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka that you can find on roka.com. Roka are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and high-performance eyewear. But also, in the last couple of years, they have really, really pushed the envelope when it comes to developing eyewear, glasses, prescription glasses, and sunglasses for both performance for sports, but also for day-to-day. And the same attitude and innovative spirit that started back in a garage in Texas when Roka set out to develop the world's fastest wetsuit carries through to their eyewear line today. So go and check out all of the prescription glasses and sunglasses. They are really super high quality. I use the Rory prescription glasses and love them. You can get 20% off your order on roka.com/TTS. Without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Coach Mark Pierce. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. And you?
Good, thanks. Why don't you start by introducing yourself to the audience and tell us a bit more about your background in the sport and what you're currently doing?
I'm Mark Pierce. I'm a physiologist by background. I graduated in 2000 with a master's, and I started work immediately in sailing, which is sort of not the most obvious route for a physiologist. But at the time, there was very few physiologists being employed by sports, certainly applied physiologists. And I had the opportunity to work there. So I started there for a couple of years, and that's when I moved to triathlon. So the endurance sport is my background and in sport. And the opportunity to work at Olympic triathlon was too much to refuse. So I moved to Loughborough and was physiologist, sports scientist, performance scientist. We went through a variety of different titles at the time, and then sort of that kept me entertained for a few years. So I went through Athens Olympics, Beijing Olympics as physiologist, and then after that I'd sort of moved my way up into management. So I didn't really like management. I like doing things, not telling people to do things. So I ended up, to cut a long story short, as the head coach for the High Performance Centre in Loughborough. So the UK has two high performance centres, one in Loughborough, one in Leeds. And so I was coaching athletes like Adam Bowden, Mark Buckingham. I coached Lucy Hall for London 2012 Olympics. Matt Sharp, who won under 23 Worlds in 2013, I think. Can't remember now. And then So post 2012, we had a management shift, and I decided that it wasn't the right place for me anymore, and I wanted to go long. I had a young family, and so I moved into doing what I do now, which is running intelligent triathlon training, coaching pro and age group, middle distance, long distance athletes normally, although I do coach a couple of athletes who do the sort of ITU sprint and standard distance events.
Yeah, great. And did you have were you racing triathlon yourself, or?
I've done two triathlons, both of which were 6 or 7 years before I even got into the world of triathlon. So I'm a cyclist by background. I raced internationally as a junior and first couple of years as a senior before they were under 23 categories. And then I decided I wasn't quite good enough to meet the demands of what I wanted. So I needed to get a life. I needed to get a job. So I went back and redid my education and became a sports scientist.
All right, great. So let's start with a very, very difficult question, perhaps the most difficult one I'll ask you, but I think it's one that I'm very keen to hear your take on, especially since you have this strong background in physiology, but in applied physiology and in coaching, obviously. And that is, can you give an overview of your main coaching/training principles?
That's a tricky question. I think it's a great question, but it's a tricky one because for me, I don't have one sort of overriding, principle that sort of a one liner that you can dish out that sort of encompasses everything. For me, I'm a problem solver, and as a scientist and as a coach, it's all for me. I see coaching as a series of problems that you're trying to solve. An athlete comes to you. They want to get better, and so you look at the whole problem. Where are they now? How do they get to where they want to be? And then it's unpicking what needs to be done. So I guess if I had to sort of put a label on it, one of the things we have on the website is focus informed and objective triathlon coaching in partnership with an athlete. So because for me, again, the athlete needs to be a part of that journey. Some coaches are very dictatorial and some athletes like that. But for me, I need athletes to be engaged in the process, and I need to be engaged in their process as well to be able to deliver the best coaching. I worked with Joel Filial, obviously very well known, probably one of the highest profile coaches in the sport at the moment. So I worked with him back in 2010 through 2014 when he was head coach for British Triathlon. And what some of the sort of topics we were talking about then, and I think it's one of the phrases he uses at the moment, is something along the lines of the minimum amount of training for the maximum amount of training adaptation. And I mean, that's something we've discussed and I agree with as well. Triathlon, especially in the longer distances, tends to be about how much volume or how much training can you do. Whereas actually I try, and especially when you work with age group athletes, trying to work out what's the best response you can get for the minimum amount of training. That's certainly something we work with a lot of athletes on.
Yeah. And that brings me to one of my follow-up questions on that, which would be, what are the main areas where you see athletes often go wrong when it comes to training? And I imagine that just doing too much volume might be one of your answers. Do you have any other points that you want to point out?
I think social media, to be honest. One of the biggest problems I see with a lot of people, and I've had this with a number of athletes that come in, and they see things on social media, and it's Jan Frodeno or a major player hitting some big session or explaining their training days, and they see these things, and people just want to jump straight in and do it, and I should be doing that, or I need that piece of equipment, or. And a lot of the times it's scattergun approach. It's not a systematic, considered, planned, periodized program or plan. They're just jumping on the next bandwagon. Nutrition's another great example. There's so much stuff out there on nutrition and diets and this and that. And for some people, these things will be appropriate. And for some people, they'll be appropriate in the future or potentially in the past. But a lot of the time it's jumping from one thing to the next without really having that plan.
Yeah, that makes sense. And one thing that we talked about before we started recording, actually, that we might want to touch on is you mentioned over-racing as well as something that this year during the pandemic, you've seen that a lot of athletes have learned to see how much progress they can make with no races on the calendar. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's been an interesting one. I'm sure you've had the same as well with... athletes love racing, so of course they want to go and race. And if you're an age grouper and that's the goal of your program is to race and enjoy and have a social fun, that's great. But if you're trying to qualify for things or you want to maximize your performance, you can't race every week or every other week throughout the season and expect to continue improving. You just can't do all the training and the recovery and the performances in races that are required to move forward. So this period where we've had obviously no races and the progress that we've been able to build upon from the winter and continuing, obviously we've changed training because there's anticipation of racing and we've put in some practice sort of race-like events. But we've seen pretty much everybody across the board more improvement than we would normally see in a season because we've been able to focus upon the process of training and improving performance. Now, next year when races return, hopefully, then we're obviously not going to have quite the same way we can do that. But the lessons can be taken from this and applied next year and in future years much more effectively, I think.
Yeah. And on that note, in a normal year where you would have races, what are your thoughts around training periodization? How do you go about that?
A lot depends upon the athlete. A lot depends upon obviously the length of the events they're looking at. So an Ironman, somebody focusing on Ironman is going to have different periodization plan to somebody who's focusing on sprint distance or standard distance races. And again, I don't have a model. I mean, many coaches have a model that they apply and a very, very strict principle of we do this and they base their careers or their coaching businesses around that model. For me, I don't have a model. I take each individual as an individual and try to understand if a new athlete's coming in, where they are at the moment, what are their characteristics, and then where do they want to get to and where have they been? Because an athlete who's been training for a year, even if their performance level is the same as an athlete who's been training for 10 years, then what they can do and what they potentially need to do is completely different. Because of their training history and their strengths and weaknesses within that. So we tend to build each program and each periodization program is based around what the athlete, where they actually are, what they need to do, and the time that they've got available. Pros, it's a lot easier to be able to build a program because you've got pretty much all the hours in the day to play with. But an age grouper who's working a lot of hours in London or somewhere compared to an age grouper who's working at home with a lot more disposable time, the periodization plan is different. It just has to be.
What if we give an example, let's take an age mm-hmm. grouper who has been in the sport for a few years, 4 to 5 years, and they're focusing on mm-hmm. half and full distance racing. And let's say they have a normal day job and usually they do go to an office, but it's a normal job, nothing extreme mm-hmm. one side or the other. What might that look like? And let's also say that they're fairly well-rounded across the three disciplines.
I mean, periodization is just a plan, isn't it? So you hear about things like reverse periodization. To me, reverse periodization is just periodization done differently. So same as all of it is. If you're looking at sort of a middle distance athlete with a normal job, then and they've got a relatively rounded profile, the sort of default starting point to work with in the beginning is that reverse periodization. So I tend to start with actually the higher intensity, assuming they've done a little bit of training. You don't sort of give them a month off at the end of the season and then jump straight back in with this, but it's to build the fitness quickly so that you're lifting the ceiling, lifting the capacity. So we might start work with to start with some gentle but then getting more vigorous VO2 max type sessions, so polarizing training a little bit more. So there is higher intensity work in there, conditioning work to in order to support that, and low intensity volume. after a period of time, and that period of time varies depending upon, again, the athlete, the time available, etc. But sort of 8 weeks is generally a sort of a minimum, because any less than 8 weeks and you're not really going to get much of a response, training response to it. Then we start to look at developing a little bit more, a short period of fatigue resistance, and then we come back to a bit more polarization, back to a bit more fatigue resistance or threshold development work. And then as you build in towards a race, then for a lot of, especially longer distance athletes, race intensity is not actually that high. You know, if you're looking at an Ironman, typical Ironman intensity bike, for instance, would be around 80% FTP for a pretty well-conditioned athlete, 80, 82%. So actual race intensity is relatively low. So we tend to do sort of somewhere between 6 weeks and 3 weeks out from a major event, some fairly significant training blocks around race intensity. So really dialing in what powers can they hold, what speeds can they hold for running, and getting them to really learn to feel that, develop all the specific muscular adaptations around that, the neurological side of things, and the psychology of it as well, getting used to what race intensity feels like for race durations.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. So basically, you're focusing quite a large period of the season there, building up to the race on building the engine in what you deem would be the optimal way, and then a specificity comes close to the race in a fairly short and concentrated period.
Yeah, I mean, one of the topics we were going to talk about is periodization, but for me, that's the plan is everything, really. And I'm having a decent plan for an athlete and having a plan that they can engage in and understand is fundamental to them being able to buy into the program or to the plan that you as the coach are trying to deliver. It's some of the tools you think with the technology we have now, so it would be a lot easier, but I tend to find a lot of the tools we have now make it harder to actually get a decent plan put together and outlined so that athletes can understand it and sort of engage in it.
Can you give an example? Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, most coaches would use Training Peaks, I think, for planning training, because it is the standard, I suppose, in the industry. I'm sure people are going to say there's other platforms like Today's Plan and various other places, but most coaches will use Training Peaks in one form or another to set play. But their periodization and their planning and their ability to communicate with athletes is pretty poor. Their ATP is horrific, in my opinion. And there's very little ways of communicating that. So you need to go outside that. So I'm sure every coach listening has probably got a spreadsheet somewhere or an Excel document or a Word document or a shared folder or something like that with all sorts of comments and observations and feedback and things like that. What I've been sort of working on for the last couple of years in my own practice is trying to develop a better system for that. So creating a database to enable us to do an awful lot more. So we talk about things, obviously you've got the basic training types and sessions and things, but there's a lot more goes on as well. It's sort of things like if you're adding a strength and conditioning or plyometrics, or if you're trying to do a heat adaptation phase, or you've got an athlete who is doing a nutrition strategy or something like that. All those things you can't very easily fit into Training Peaks or anything like that, because there's nowhere to put them, nowhere to really effectively communicate them very well.
Yeah.
Those things I think are really, really important.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I to my mind, I start visualizing some sort of timeline with where you can make annotations and tagging
exactly.
And that sort of thing. But yeah, you're right. That's not really easy to do in there. And exactly, if you're stuck with the ATP and Training Peaks, I mean, I never look at it.
It's useless.
All right. And one thing that I want to get back to that you mentioned there was the 8 weeks or minimum for the VO2 max block. Can you elaborate on that? Does that apply to other types of training as well, that generally you want to focus on one or a couple of types of training and do that for a pretty extended amount of time to really see the benefits? Or how do you view that?
Yes and no. I mean, some types of training. So if you're looking at things like threshold development, then you're looking 6 to 8 weeks really minimum. If you do a couple of weeks of threshold sessions, you might notice some very acute changes. So typically you see it in a training block. Week one, somebody finds a threshold session fairly hard. Next week, they find it a little bit easier. That's basically neuromuscular and psychological, I think. People are starting to adapt very, very acutely to that type of training session. If you want to see meaningful chronic adaptations, you need a prolonged period of time working on developing a physiological system. Now, you can't isolate each individual system and go, right, we're going to specifically develop threshold or VO2 max, because the training will have impact on all areas. But if you want to be able to develop a certain type of training, you need to be able to do it for a sustained period of time. Having said that, some things like sort of sweet spot training or tempo work, then we would sometimes use a 4 or 5 or even a 6 week block, but that's pretty much the limit on proper sweet spot type training that I would consider. I think once you start to go beyond that for a lot of athletes, then the training load becomes very, very high, because sweet spot sessions, those hard endurance sessions, have huge training loads. And any longer than that, then you're starting to push people over the edge, and the quality starts to go, and the fatigue, you're just making them tired, you're not making them fitter.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And in a specific block like that, how do you view the reversibility of the gains you've made in previous blocks? Like, for example, would you do your inner threshold block, but before that you did a VO2 max block? Would you keep some VO2 max training in there still to maintain those gains, or how do you view that?
Yeah, yes, you would keep a little bit in there. I think naturally that happens anyway. But the high end, I mean, VO2 max, it's a funny sort of subject, because a lot of people go, oh, VO2 max is irrelevant. And I wouldn't say it's irrelevant. It's not a great predictor of performance, but it doesn't mean to say it's irrelevant. Because the ceiling, if you want to run a, let's say for argument's sake, 40-minute 10K, you can't run a 40-minute 10K if your VO2 max is 45 mils per kilo. Similarly, if you've got a VO2 max of 70 mils per kilo and you're only running 40 minutes, then you're doing, there's something else somewhere. So it's one of those factors that understanding where it is helps to understand your potential limitations.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's two types with VO2 max. You can get improved VO2 max through high volume training or low intensity, and you can improve it through intervals. The responses that you get are slightly different depending upon the type of training. I tend to find the higher intensity work on a VO2 max work will lead to quicker response, but a shorter term, it'll be more acute. So the reversibility will be faster. If you're able to if you've got the time to do a high volume program with low intensity and you do enough of it, those adaptations are much more chronic and will stick around for a lot longer. So hence the reason why polarization kind of hits both marks. So you're either training very hard and working on VO2 max, or you're training very easy and getting a high volume. However, most age groupers can't do the kind of volume in a polarized program that you'd need to get those big adaptations from the volume side of it, because they haven't got 25 hours a week to train. We tend to try and consolidate when you've done a higher intensity block to develop, like say something like VO2 max, you're trying to consolidate that and retain the benefits and the gains from it without actually sort of reducing them or very small reverses in performance or capacity, whilst allowing the athlete to recover and developing something else. So yeah, you would keep, even in a sweet spot block, for instance, there would still be an element of some high intensity in there, just a lot less.
Yeah. And let's get into that topic of polarized training. You mentioned 25 hours. Do you think that, just elaborate on your views on the volume required to really get the benefits from it. And do you think that it's dependent on your history in the sport? Like, for example, for somebody who is in their, an age grouper that's in their second or third year of triathlon, they don't have a big background in endurance sports, the threshold for when it is useful might be a lot less than for somebody who has been doing triathlon for 10 years and are already very fit for an age grouper. Or how do you view that, those parts as well, of what the minimum amount of volume required would be for it to be successful?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's $1 million question, isn't it? I mean, polarization is one of those sort of social media topics at the moment that's quite popular, and you know, a lot of people are polarizing training a lot. For me, polarization is just part of the process. I'm not a polarized coach. We use polarized training, but it has its place within an overall program. I went to a talk at the University of Loughborough probably a year or so ago now, and it was about this sort of topic, training loads and training periodization and things. One of the presenters was presenting a lot of work on Kenyan runners and saying, you know, the 80% volume, 20% sort of intensity. It doesn't have to be VO2 max. Polarization is just over threshold, basically, over second threshold, FTP, LT2, whatever you want to call it. So it doesn't have to be flat out, but it does mean it's fairly high intensity. One of the things that struck me when they presented that, and one of my sort of, I guess, issues with polarization as a model for training is these elite athletes, they were doing 80% volume, 20% high intensity. But the high intensity, 20% of a lot of training is a lot of high intensity. If you're doing 20 hours a week and you're doing 20% of your training over threshold, you've got 4, 5, potentially some of these athletes up to 6 hours of over threshold training a week. That's nearly as much training as some age groupers would do in a week, period. So for me, is the adaptation to polarization because of the amount of intensity that they do, or is it because of the combination of the volume and the intensity? If you're an age grouper with 10 to 12 hours training to play with over the course of a week across swim, bike, and run, it's going to be incredibly difficult to get enough volume in to match that 80% volume, 20% intensity. Whereas your quality training sessions are going to be extremely small, because you've only got sort of an hour and a half to play with to do your 20%, if you like. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And yeah. It's something that, a couple of other coaches that I talked to have said the same thing. I remember recently Sebastian Weber, for example, said something very similar there to what you did.
Yeah. So, I've seen social media posts and things, Facebook and Instagram, of coaches jumping on this bandwagon, but they don't really understand the mechanisms of what's working. Just because some elite Ironman athlete is using a polarized approach for some of the season, that doesn't necessarily apply down. And it's one of the things I think as a physiologist who is a coach, I would classify myself much more as a coach than I would as a physiologist, certainly now. I've been out of the physiology world for quite a long time. But one of the things that you learn is the ability to be able to analyze and understand the process and apply it, not just regurgitate what's published in a study. So you read the study and you're trying to understand the principles of what it's trying to say. And then as a coach, I can then interpret that and use that as part of the program. And I think this is polarization and the periodization research is a good example of that, because too many people just jump on what our research study said about elite athletes and we need to transfer that to age group athletes. And it's not necessarily valid.
Yeah. So to put it another way, you're saying essentially that maybe the percentage isn't the most important thing, but it's actually the absolute amount of intensity that is important, which means that age groupers that are training at lower volume can have very different percentages than elite athletes, especially when we're talking long distance triathletes that might be training up.
Wouldn't go as far as saying they need to be trying to get 6 hours of high quality training in, like an elite runner or an elite triathlete would be able to do. But the percentage of you doing 80 and 20% isn't necessarily going to work out, because irrespective of the original part of the question, irrespective of the background of the athlete or the experience of them, what the interesting part for me then is the intensity needs to be low. So when you do the easy part, because again, with polarization, there are three zones. You have below first threshold, between first threshold and second threshold, and then above second threshold. And again, that first zone, a lot of people misinterpret what that first zone represents as an intensity, because it's called zone one. They will look to misinterpret it by looking at classical zone one, like a 6 or 7 zone model system, which is actually pretty easy. Well, zone one is below a roughly 70-75% FTP, which is actually still quite hard work. So if you were training at 70% FTP for your volume, you'd actually still be working pretty hard for most people.
Yeah, definitely.
And so it's managing that balance of being able to get people to train. If you've only got a few hours, you might need to train your volume closer to that 70% mark. If you're a pro and you're doing 20 hours of volume biking and running a month or whatever, a week, sorry, then you're going to have to do that at a lower intensity, because if you tried to do 10, 12, 13 hours of biking at 70% FTP, you're going to be buried after a week or two.
Yeah. I read a paper the other day, which was a retrospective 4-year analysis of 21 World Tour cyclists, I think from Team Sunweb. and their average intensity factor, so average percentage of FTP that they had in all the training sessions across those 4 years was 0.59, so 59% was the average. Yeah. But then we're talking about athletes that if they go and ride at 75%, which would still be right at sort of at that LT1, so in the zone one in the polarized model, they would be riding at 300 watts probably, or close to it.
Yeah, I was going
to
say all their training rides would be over 40k an hour.
Yeah.
But the training load would be huge then and unsustainable.
Yeah. Yeah,
if you're only doing 4 hours biking a week, or I say only, I'm sure some people are probably listening thinking, oh, I wish I could do 4 hours a week. But if you're only doing 4 hours a week, if you do it at 59% and you're as you said, you've got 4 or 5 years training history, there's no training overload. There's no training. You have to also think of the principles of training. There has to be an overload. There has to be some kind of specificity to it. And 49, 50%. Up to sort of 60% for only a few hours a week is not going to be enough for an experienced triathlete to create an adaptation to.
Yeah. You mentioned there one aspect of your physiology background that helps you in coaching. Are there any other things that you draw upon regularly that helps you having that dual background now in physiology and coaching that you find particularly useful?
I think the most valuable thing of my physiology background, or my science background, if you like, is understanding the process rather than the sort of education that, or the things that I learned. It's understanding how to, coaching is a best guess, isn't it? So we don't know the answers. We're educated, we have experience, and we see a situation or an athlete in front of us. You're then looking at the athlete, evaluating the performances they've done, evaluating the data that they can provide or the experiences that they can tell you about. And then you're, as a coach, formulating a hypothesis about what's going to be the best way forward for them. You plan that out, you execute it. And at some point you should be retesting that. Now that test might be a race, or it might be a performance test, or a physiology test, or a lab test, or something. But essentially you're going through that process of hypothesis, test, evaluate, create a new hypothesis. And excuse me. And that sort of philosophy, I guess, I said I didn't have much of a philosophy, but there you go. That kind of philosophy, I think, is really important to being able to continue to develop an athlete. And that's the same when you look at studies that come out and papers and new research and things like that. It's being able to pick it all apart and understanding how these things come about, so that I can then use that information in a way with the athletes that I coach.
Yeah. In terms of new science coming out, one thing that I've been very interested in reading about recently is different types of intervals. And most recently on the podcast, I interviewed Michael Rosenblatt, who did a meta-analysis on different types of intervals. And he found that across the literature, the published literature, it seems that longer high-intensity intervals, we're talking 4 minutes or so, 4 minutes or even longer, might be more effective than shorter 1-2 minute intervals, and also more effective than sprint intervals, so 30-second intervals or so. I'm curious to hear your thoughts around high-intensity intervals. Is this something that, do you have any particular thoughts in that area, or do you mix and match a little bit, or how do you...
Yeah, I would say we mix and match suitable for what the athlete's trying to do at a particular time. I mean, I would agree that I think the slightly longer intervals are more powerful, but they're also higher impact. So as I sort of started when we were talking about periodization, then we might put out a VO2 max block at the beginning of the winter training. That would tend to be the slightly, for want of a better term, easier way of being able to do it, because you're trying to build the athlete in. So the reps would be a bit shorter. There might be a little bit less overall volume. And we increase that as we go along. When you start to get to the more serious end, if you like, then the intervals become longer, or the block. I mean, the classic VO2 max block is 40 seconds on, 20 seconds, 40 seconds at power at VO2 max, 20 seconds at, depending upon who you read, a little bit easier, sort of steady pace, if you like. And you're trying to accumulate something like 20 minutes worth of that block across the course of your session. So it might be broken down into 2 10-minutes like that or something. There you've got an example of a 40-second interval, but although it's a 40-second interval, it's not. It's really a 10-minute 10-minute block where you're trying to elevate VO2 max or oxygen consumption and make it last as long as you possibly can. Compare that with doing a sort of more classic 4-minute rep or 5-minute rep at VO2 max, then it's going to take a lot longer to accumulate the same amount of time at VO2 max. But the response is very different.
Yeah, yeah. So you're saying that it's spent longer with the shorter or the longer?
So I think you can accumulate more when you're using the slightly shorter intervals. Okay. So if you're doing the 40 seconds on, 20 seconds off, then because that 20 seconds is like a micro rest, it's not a full rest, it's not for very long. It just enables heart rate to just drop a couple of beats, your oxygen consumption goes down ever so slightly, you're able to just about recover a little bit. Therefore, you can prolong the amount of work that you can do as a continuous block. I mean, to do a 10-minute block at VO2 max is theoretically impossible. Mm. But what you're trying to do with those 40 seconds on the 20, you're trying to accumulate sort of up to about 10 or 12 minutes of doing that work. And that basically prolongs in that one interval, then you're prolonging the amount of time that you're spending close to VO2 max.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to doing a 4 or a 5 minute effort where you're going to do 4 or 5 minutes. Now the first 30, 40, 50, 60 seconds is going to be getting elevation of heart rate and oxygen consumption. Then you're going to be hanging on for the next 2 or 3 minutes, depending upon how long your interval is. Then you need a fairly long recovery because of the fatigue and the buildup of hydrogen ions and things like that that's associated with it. So you need a long flush out period before you can repeat that again. You might still get 20 minutes worth of work in, but you're doing it in shorter blocks, but at a more sustained power output or running speed.
And when you're doing a VO2 max block, keeping on that topic a little bit, but how many sessions might you be doing then in a week, and how would you spread it out across the disciplines?
I mean, as a triathlete, obviously you're focusing across, generally those types of sessions are bike and run for me. We do VO2 max swim sessions as well, but it doesn't work, I don't think, in quite the same way because a lot of the time swimming is more technically limited and there's a lot more factors at play there, I think, with swimming. So if we're focusing on just the biking and the running side of things, then in some cases, it may have across the two disciplines, it may have 5 sessions in a week, which is quite a lot. For some athletes, there might only be 2 or 3. And that can change throughout the course of the season. How many we do might also impact, it might be affected by how big those sessions are, so what the load of each particular session is. So if, for instance, we're doing that early phase block in a polarized model, we might do 5 VO2 max sessions in the course of the week, but none of them will be pushing the boundaries of what the athlete can actually do. If we want to get to that stage, then we might be dropping that down to 3 or potentially 4.
Yeah, makes sense. And what about your thoughts on nutrition in and out of training? And you mentioned sometimes applying some specific strategies. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Nutrition is something I've worked with nutritionists. So as part of the program, I've worked with nutritionists since 20 years now. And I think I've probably really appreciated the work that they do a lot more in the last probably 2 or 3 years. Because a part of that is because the amount of information that's out there now, athletes get really confused, or they get great clarity about what they're going to do, and it's completely wrong for them, and so they end up in a bit of a pickle. So for me, nutrition has a really big part to play. It's just finding the right balance of how to use nutrition and when to use the right thing. There's definitely nutritional strategies that can be employed. You've got sort of acute strategies for races. You've got chronic strategies for longer term training and life in general. Again, I don't have a single nutritional strategy. I'm not high fat, low carb, or high carb, low fats, or paleo, or anything in particular. I think, what I've seen, my experience is all of these things work for someone. It's matching the right strategy at the right time with the right training to get the response that you want. From my personal experience, I gain weight relatively quickly if I eat a little bit too much or I don't do any training, and it just goes on very quickly and comes off very slowly. I found for myself, if I wasn't training very much, reducing the carbohydrate and having a slightly higher fat content basically dropped weight off. I was able to maintain my weight and or lose weight much, much quicker. However, as soon as I start training hard, if I don't have carbohydrates, I'm not a particularly great fat burner in training. My fat threshold is relatively low. If I start training and I start training relatively hard, if I don't increase the carbohydrate content, I blow up after about 2 weeks and I can't do anything. I'm useless. Whereas, I've seen other athletes that we've tested in the lab, they've got immense fat burning capacity, well over a gram per minute, and nearly all the way through to second threshold. And, it's incredible. Those guys can operate on a completely different nutritional strategy to me, and athletes in the same boat as me. So for me, nutrition is like training. There are loads of different tools about to play with. You need to find the right tool or the right strategy for the right athlete at the right time.
Yeah. And would you say that generally you would want a lab test as the basis for prescribing any particular strategy, or just having the discussion with an athlete you coach that this might or might not work for you? Or are there any other ways than an actual lab test to assess that?
I mean, they've got lab tests. You've got the inside testing that Sebastian Weber does that give you an estimation or a measurement of fat burning capacity and fat max. The other thing, it's not ideal, but not every athlete has either the resources or the time or the opportunity to get to a decent lab. And I do stress decent lab, because there's a lot of people out there offering the fat testing or metabolic carts for testing and things. A lot of it is rubbish, though. So either the equipment's rubbish or the person delivering its understanding of what they're doing is rubbish, and rubbish in, rubbish out. So sometimes you haven't got the opportunity to be able to do that, and you've got to take the experiences of the athlete and test them out a little bit. It's usually quite easy to find out if somebody is a good or bad fat burner or a carb muncher, just by giving them a couple of training sessions, either restricting or applying carbohydrates, and see what happens. Now, you haven't obviously got any objective data to be able to use from that. You can't determine whether what the rates are or anything with any precision. So your benchmark for being able to test whether they've improved or not is pretty blunt. But in some cases, that's what you've got to play with as a coach. So you make the most of that. But yes, ideally, we would see people through a lab and be able to test and retest.
Yeah. And would you implement a nutrition periodization? Let's say you have somebody who you think does need carbs generally in training, but would you have some periods in training where you deliberately restrict carbohydrates mm-hmm. still to maybe work on that?
For the right athletes, yeah, definitely. I had an athlete come to me last summer, and his training numbers were good, thresholds were good. He was an Ironman athlete, and he kept saying, "Yeah, I'm only averaging 75% on the bike, 75% FTP on the bike." Excuse me a second. Sorry, he was only averaging 75% FTP on the bike, which was well within his capacity. He said, "I'm getting off the bike, I feel great. I blow up every time after about 5-6K on the marathon." And we looked at it, and he was possibly the worst fat burner I've ever seen. So even at 75% FTP, he was still burning an enormous amount of carbohydrate. Yet physiologically, the potential was there to go much, much quicker. He just literally couldn't consume enough carbohydrate to be able to fuel the intensity that he could ride and run at. So it didn't really matter what he did. He couldn't finish the run at a decent pace because he was completely carb depleted. So in his case, then yes, we had to pretty much take a very drastic intervention to be able to improve that fat burning ability, so that he's not turning over. He will always burn carbohydrates, but not what we were trying to do was reduce his reliance on carbohydrates and improve his ability to be able to burn fats as a fuel. Conversely, some people only need a little nudge sometimes, or it's part of their taper process, or and there can be a variety of different reasons on why you would want to improve that and periodize nutrition. For an Ironman athlete, the ability to burn fats as a fuel is really useful, but you've got to remember, you can still provide 70, 80, 90 grams of carbs every hour for a marathon and for an Ironman. It's, we have the availability to be able to do that. So you don't need to become this super duper fat burner and potentially compromise your training in order to do that. However, if you're like my first example, then you do need to do something about it.
Yeah, makes sense.
If you're training for a sprint, a standard, and you're potentially specializing in 70.3, it's not so big an issue, because as long as you go into an event fully carb replete, you can provide enough carbohydrates for pretty much any intensity that you can maintain throughout that event. So as long as you've got a good nutrition strategy, then you can supply that. The other side to that discussion is also the training adaptation. So by restricting carbohydrates, you might not be trying to create an adaptation to improve fat mobilization. You might be trying to create other adaptations. And so, yes, definitely we use different strategies like that throughout the course of the year with athletes.
Yeah. And another thing I know that you've worked quite a lot with is heat adaptation, I think for the Beijing Olympics, maybe the Athens Olympics mm-hmm. as well. So can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that? And maybe even, I assume that he has developed since then. It's 12 years ago now. So what are your thoughts these days around heat adaptation?
I mean, I think it's important, particularly, I mean, a lot of the athletes I coach are UK-based. And as you know, we don't have the warmest climate here, especially during the summer. And, you know, a lot of them tend to race foreign races. So they'll be in Spain or Europe or across the States, where the weather is quite often considerably warmer. So we do have to go along the lines of some form of heat adaptation. You know, we can see 10, sometimes 15% performance decrement by not being heat adapted. And what's changed over the last few years for me is the ways in which we can do that. I've always been a subscriber to training relatively hard in the heat chamber. So once you've got an initial familiarization with it, then being able to do high quality sessions, you're trying to raise core temperature, you're improving sweat rates to try and help with your cooling capacity when you get outside. So I've always been a fan of being able to do quite hard training sessions in there. And funnily enough, one of the things that sticks the most in my mind was training with Holly Avil, who was one of the women who went to Beijing Olympics, in that we did a lot of heat adaptation work with her because she was not particularly good at it. And after about, I can't remember exactly the numbers now, but after a few weeks, we were seeing huge improvements in performance outside in cool climates. What we were seeing was basically a sort of like an altitude exposure. We're seeing plasma volume expansion. We're seeing improved buffering capacities. Just physiologically, she was getting, with the sessions she was doing, she was fine getting a much better training response than she would do if you were doing it outside. Also, the coach she had at the time, we were able to do much more specific training, because you have to be fairly specific when you're in that sort of environment. And I think that also had a big impact on her fitness. So even after Beijing Olympics had gone, we continued to do heat chamber sessions with her. And I still find that valuable with many athletes to actually make sure that some of their indoor sessions now, and not everybody's got a heat chamber in their backyard. So you've got to kind of make do what you've got at home. But training inside with the fan off for a period of time, or when the room is warm, you can get, you obviously create a heat adaptation, a heat stress there, and that does add to your training effect. So that's one of the sort of big things I think I learned and I've taken forward from that. More recently, we've started to do a lot of passive heat training, so using things like hot tubs and saunas to exacerbate that heat adaptation effect and to try and get it without creating such a high training stress, because heat chamber sessions do create a very high training load and it will create an additional fatigue. So if we can get passive heat adaptation effects from using those sort of facilities, then it's been a no-brainer. I worked with Kim Morrison for a number of years, and her family own a hot tub company, basically. So she obviously had one. And we started using that pretty regularly. And when I first started coaching her, she was terrible in the heat, just really didn't tolerate heat very well at all. Within a few weeks of doing this just passive heat chamber sessions, passive heat sessions in the hot tub, we were finding significant improvements in her races in the heat. And now that's just, or I don't coach her any at the moment, but all the way through the next 3 or 4 years, then we were using those strategies then as pretty much all the time. So she always had some level of heat adaptation.
How long and how often would you generally recommend doing those passive heat sessions? Let's say in the case of an age grouper, so maybe you do have to like time instead of premium, so to say, but they have qualified for Kona, they live in the UK. What is the best sort of trade-off, bang for buck?
We're generally trying to avoid going more than 3 days without an exposure. So once you start to go 3, 4, 5 days without a heat exposure, then the adaptations you've made up to that point will start to reverse. So we're generally trying to say less than, keeping it to within no more than 2 day gap between sessions. It might be that I would rarely do one back to back, like Monday, Tuesday, for instance. It would normally be something like Monday, Wednesday, Saturday or something. And then you might be back to Monday, Wednesday, Saturday again. So you're looking for around 3 per week. Some people go overboard. I've seen people go overboard and basically sit for an hour in the sauna every day, and that will just exhaust you. That won't help. It doesn't increase the power of the adaptation. So doing too much doesn't amplify the effect. It just makes you knackered. It's like training, getting the right dose is an important part of it. And if you're doing 3 passive sessions and a 1 or potentially 2 training sessions in the heat in a 14 day to 21 day period, that's going to be upper limit of what I think people should be doing or could be doing.
Just be careful if you ever coach any Finnish people, because they might associate sitting in the sauna with also having a beer or two
with
or
daily
three.
Life.
So that's something you take into account. That might also.
I'm not convinced it wouldn't apply to some people here as well. But I mean, another part of that is that the temperature is really important. So most of the research that's been done on that passive adaptation effect has been done on in sort of hot tubs or baths. And you need water temperature over 40 degrees. It has to be hotter than the body. What we've tried to do, obviously not everybody has a hot tub in their garden or accessible. So with some athletes, we've tried to do it with a bath at home. And the biggest problem with a bath at home is it cools down. You can fill it deep enough and sure, you can submerge yourself because, again, you need to be fairly submerged in it. But the biggest problem is just trying to keep the water temperature hot enough. And when I've heard quite a few funny stories, when people have first been suggested that they do this, they're like, oh, that sounds quite nice. Believe me, a 40 degree bath is not particularly pleasant. I'm not sure which is worse, an ice bath or a hot bath. I'm pretty sure, I think for me, the hot bath would be worse.
Mm, yeah. And with the active heat adaptation, and again, let's take the age grouper example, somebody who does not have a heat chamber. So you mentioned they're turning off the fan. What would the protocol be for the active training? And let's take Kona as an example. How often and what types of sessions are you doing? For how long do you do it without a fan? Prescribe doing it in a smaller room than normal to get the heat up, or with some sort of layering and more clothes on than normal?
I mean, if you haven't got good facilities for it, i.e. a lab or a heat chamber, then you're going to be trying to make do with what you can resource and how you can do it. So for instance, Kona, humidity is important. Humidity really is the factor in Kona. The heat isn't super hot, but the wet bulb temperature is off the scale because of the humidity. So first of all, if you're training for Kona, you need humidity. If you're training to do something in a desert somewhere where it's incredibly dry, the humidity is not so much the factor, it's the absolute temperature. So first part is trying to replicate the conditions that you're expecting to be in. So because an important part of the adaptation is the psychology of it as well, is what does it feel like? And being soaking wet the whole time because you just can't get rid of the heat because you've got a layer of water on your skin the whole time does take a bit of getting used to. The next factor then you're looking at is, I wouldn't have the fan off for a long period of time because you will always have airflow over you. As long as you're moving forward, you'll have airflow over you. And if you're trying to replicate the conditions of Kona, so 30 plus degrees and 70, 80, 90% humidity, if you turn the fan off, you'll have no airflow over you whatsoever. And you will just boil. So it might be a way that if you can't actually get the room to the required temperature or humidity, you might turn the fan off a little bit to try and pop that temperature up or the conditions up a little bit. But I wouldn't try and do it for a long period of time without the fan on. Because the other thing you also want is you want the quality of training. If your quality of training in the heat chamber is so poor, then you might be well heat adapted, but you won't be very fit. So there's obviously a balance between being able to do your training and getting a heat adaptation. The other risk at home, of course, and this should be emphasized, is in a lab, if you go into a lab for a heat chamber session, if your core temperature goes over 40 degrees, then they will stop you, which can be a limitation because quite a lot of athletes will go over 40 degrees internal core temperature during the course of very hot events. And some people, you know, the reason for that 40 degrees is ethical consideration. It's considered dangerous or potentially life-threatening when you go much over 40 degrees. But it does happen in the real world. And, you know, athletes have to be able to sometimes do that and understand what it feels like. At home, you can't really measure core temperature accurately. So you have to be careful, and I wouldn't advise doing it in an environment when you're on your own. So because if the worst did happen and you keeled over and there's nobody there for a few hours, then it could get very messy. So there is that consideration. I probably can't emphasize that enough. But the sessions that we would do would vary depending upon the athlete. I tend to take the sessions that we would do outside and transfer them to an equivalent or a version of it indoors. So for some sessions, that might be some sweet spot work. So getting used to long sustained efforts to try and get core temperature up. For some people, it might be more high intensity work with increasing sort of power over threshold for short periods of time. There's not one answer. I've seen really good. I've seen people do both types of training or two types of training and get very different responses. You give the same thing to somebody else and they get another response. That's the beauty of what we do, is everybody is to some degree unique, certainly fairly unique anyway.
Yep. Yeah, those are some really great points and considerations, and definitely that specificity of the environment in regard to humidity as well as temperature was great that you pointed that out. One more question here that I wanted to pick your brains on was transitioning from draft legal racing to non-draft in triathlon, which I understand that you've helped quite a few athletes with that. So what are your mm-hmm. thoughts on that, the different demands of the long distance versus short distance draft legal racing?
The standard in Ironman and 70.3 has gone up dramatically, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years because of the amount of people crossing over from ITU racing and moving the standards on across the speed on the run. and a lot of sort of, certainly at the elite side of things, a lot of people think the ITU guys, they can't ride, they're just swim runners. I think we're seeing that that's not true because, you know, you've got people like Frodo and Annie Haag who come from an ITU background now winning and establishing some pretty impressive times and performances in Ironman. And they're not the only ones. There's quite a lot of people coming across. I think a big part of the transition is it suits some people more than it suits other people. And a lot of that is to do potentially with their physiology or their mindset. Some ITU athletes run a relatively low volume, fairly high intensity program. Some have more volume in their program and are probably better as a generalization, probably better suited to coming across to 70.3 and Ironman quickly because they have the endurance, they have the volume to do it. Whereas other athletes who have focused more upon the speed side of things and the quality of it, they struggle a bit more with trying to sustain a fairly hard but not really hard intensity for 2, 3, 4 hours on the bike and then the same on the run. So I think that the standards are very high. I think it's an interesting time.
What would be the main thing? Are there things that generally change when you take on an athlete that is, or somebody that you already coach perhaps, that is transitioning mm-hmm. from short course to long course? Are the generalizations that you can make there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in ITU, if you're racing in ITU at a high level, at elite level, or as a high level age grouper, then you've got the particular attributes. The swim is de-emphasized for sure. So it's good ITU swimmers, for instance, generally come across, we're talking pro level, ITU swimmers generally come across and they can make front packs without too much hard work in Ironman or 70.3. The swim volume will generally decrease a little bit because their bike volume needs to go up. Generally, in an ITU program, the running is slightly more important because that's where the race is won. And in most cases, the fastest runner will win the race, more or less. They need to be in the game, but the running does have a much higher emphasis. We also tend to see higher volumes run by ITU athletes. So although the race is only 10K, then a lot of the volume, there's usually a lot more volume done by ITU athletes than there is even by Ironman athletes, in my experience. And that's because they then de-emphasize the running volume to increase the right cycling volume, and because the cycling becomes much, much more significant. You can't give away 10 minutes on the bike and then expect to run that down on a 70.3 anymore. And so the biking has to be robust. But also, if you're going to ride that hard for that long, if you're not extremely well conditioned, you can't do it. But also, even if you can do it, if you're not extremely well conditioned, you get off and you can't run properly. You can't run it as effectively. So that biking, the riding side of things, has to be emphasized a lot more. And the mentality of riding for multiple hours really hard is a big thing to try and get over. And then there's also the fueling of it. So in ITU, they'll probably pop a couple of gels and have a bottle of something like Morton or Beta Fuel or something now. Whereas in ITU, in 70.3 and particularly Ironman, then your nutrition strategy has to be bomb-proof. And that takes practice.
Yeah, all very good points, and really interesting to hear that the run volume quite often comes down in at the professional level.
And I think you'll find a lot of the guys will be running somewhere between 80 to 100, 110K a week in the ITU sort of elites, whereas in Ironman, I've seen figures of sometimes 50 to 70, 80K. I don't know many Ironman athletes who run over 100K a week on a regular basis.
Mm, yeah. About four age groupers that are maybe... So for most age groupers, it depends a bit on which country you live in, but the short distances are still not draft legal. So it's more of a steady-state race regardless. Mm-hmm. And would you say that the differences aren't so big at all? It's mostly a matter of... just maybe increasing volume a bit if you can, depending on what you're training for.
I think it's a lot easier to transfer there because, you know, sometimes it's just the mentality of going more than twice as far. And sure, the volume needs to come up probably a little bit. And the pacing strategy has to be a little bit more controlled. I think when you're used to racing shorter, you tend to race harder. What you tend to see is people go out too hard out of transition. Because they're used to going out pretty much at threshold or FTP or close to that and then, you know, finishing in around an hour or so on the bike. When you're going to ride for 2.5 hours, it's a different proposition. You've got to control that intensity a lot more. Otherwise, you burn your carbs and then you run your risk of being depleted and fading towards the end of either the bike or the run.
Yeah.
So I think it's a lot more straightforward. Also, the swim wouldn't really change very much. The distance it increases very negligible compared to the biking and the running increase.
Yeah. And one final question before the rapid fire questions. Again, piggybacking a bit on your sports science background, what if you could recommend coaches or athletes to really study 2 to 3 topics within physiology or sports science in general and get a more sort of in-depth picture of those, perhaps topics that you feel are misunderstood or underutilized in triathlon training? What would those topics be?
I mean, I think I've been working with a younger coach. He's an ex-athlete who used to be part of the program here and came in as an athlete, trained, and he's now coaching, and I think he'd be a really great coach moving forward. One of the things that, as an athlete, he learned loads of training, loads of sessions, but didn't fully understand or didn't really understand why or what they were doing, what those sessions were doing. They were just training sessions and you do this session at this time. So for me, to really be able to have an objective view of an athlete's program, you have to understand physiology in some degree, at least to a basic degree. I think sometimes people get caught up with all the funky marginal gain stuff on how to do things, but fundamentally understanding what the body is going through makes a big difference when you start thinking about, okay, how do I structure this session? What am I trying to do with this session? How does this session then fit into the picture as a big picture? And I think that understanding physiology at a relatively basic but fundamental level is really important. And otherwise you're just regurgitating patterns that you've learnt from other people.
Yep. And do you have some resource that you recommend for people that might want to go into that?
Not really. No, I mean, there's, I think one of the, I'm going to struggle with a couple of your next questions, I know. But one of the things, I think there's so much good resources out there now available to the public. You know, some of the YouTube channels and things are excellent, but they're often very compartmentalized. And it's a difficult area, I think, to be able to start with. I mean, the obvious thing is either a coaching course, which has a good physiology background, which is not necessarily all of them. Simple things like modern textbooks. They will explain physiology, understanding what that lactate isn't the evil that it's supposed to be. You know, that's a one of my bugbears. People go, oh, my legs are full of lactate. It's like, oh, God, give me a break. Yeah. You know, understanding that's not actually a problem. It's a part of the process. Understanding what the limitations to performance are. You know, one of the things that we start with when we look at physiology is what are the limitations to performance? As an endurance athlete, you've got three main limitations: VO2 max, your economy or your efficiency, and how much of that VO2 max you can sustain for the duration of the event you want. And now you then start to look at what are the factors that affect those things, and you sort of move down the line. By doing that, you can start to unpick what athletes need to do in terms of their program. And some of the textbooks, you know, some really good textbooks out there will give you that information. It's not as interesting as watching a YouTube channel or reading somebody's blog. But I don't think there are many resources out there that are systematic. And I think that's the thing that you need to understand is the systematic. You need to work from the beginning and work through it rather than just grabbing a topic in the middle of the conversation or something.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And I thought that you might say a textbook there. So I didn't refer to YouTube channels or anything like that. One that I like is the Biochemical Basis for Sports Performance by, I think, Michael Gleason is one of the authors of that. That
one is- Mike Gleason's one of the, used to, I don't think he's here now. He used to be a lecturer here at Loughborough for a long time.
Yeah, that one is really good, but definitely if you need to be focused and concentrated going through that because it is quite technical. But
it's quite heavy going, and sometimes you can jump into something like that, but you need a more fundamental understanding of physiology before you get to that stage as well. I mean, obviously you've got very good qualifications and experience in physiology as well. For somebody who doesn't, for the average age group, doesn't really understand it, then they need to go back to almost like A-level physiology, A-levels being a sort of 17 to 18-year-old qualification in the UK, like GCSEs and things. Yep. You need to go back to that sort of level of physiology to understand it. But I think things have also changed a little bit over the last few years as our understanding of some of the mechanisms have improved. So reading stuff from the 70s isn't necessarily going to help because it's now not actually the current thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, I think even a book like Triathlon Science by Friel and Vance, you have a few chapters on physiology and they will give a good sort of basic understanding of what's going on.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the thing with all of these things is you go on Twitter and there'll be a science fight between two eminent physiologists, both of whom are probably right to a degree, but they have fundamentally different principles and different guiding lights. And as an uneducated person in that scenario, you can get very sold on basically the one who sells their message the best. It doesn't necessarily mean they're right, it just means they sold their message better.
Definitely.
It is a bit of a minefield, I will confess. Mm.
And anything else other than the understanding of the basic physiology that you want to highlight that you think would make sense for coaches or athletes to understand better?
I think planning. I mean, one of the things that for me, I really struggle. If I haven't got a plan to work to as a coach, I need to be able to see the big picture. And I like to have athletes with goals. So sometimes you have people who just want to train. And I find it really difficult to embrace that because I don't know what I'm trying to do as a coach. So I think, you know, learning to be able to plan and organize training, but planning and organizing and having got a goal philosophy. How that affects athletes and how you can use goal philosophy with different types of athletes. Because obviously some athletes are much more outcome driven. They want to beat a certain time. Some athletes are very much, I want to improve. And you know, the way in which you set goals and things will be different for those types of athletes. And that planning and pulling all the bits and pieces of your puzzle together, I think, is also very important.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet that's where some of your spreadsheets come in handy as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've been working on a database. It's taken me, I've been doing it for about 2 years, trying to find the right tools to do it. And it works for me. I don't think I could, I couldn't commercialize it because there's too many, I'm not a programmer, so there's too many footballs on it. But it's starting the process for me of actually trying to organize everything so I can present it to the athletes in a way in which they can sort of see the logic of it all. And then we can review various elements of everything. And we've got all the records and all the information other than the training data in one place.
Yeah, that's really cool. All right, so let's move on to the rapid fire questions, which are just one sentence answers. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to triathlon?
Unfortunately, I'm going to let you down. I don't have a favorite. I tend to sort of go through phases of reading bits and pieces. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to manipulate your question a little bit and tell you what's on my desk at the moment.
Yep.
So I've been doing a lot of work on strength and conditioning and improving my understanding of strength and conditioning over the last few months, part of lockdown. So I've got Strength and Conditioning for Endurance Running by Richard Blagrove on my desk at the moment. And in a similar vein, where is it? There we go. I've also got Strength and Conditioning for Cyclists by Phil Burton and Martin Evans on my desk as well at the moment.
All right, great.
Both of which are different, but pretty good reads.
Yeah. And what's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
That's like asking a mechanic, what's his favorite spanner? is it the 15 mil or the 20 mil socket? I don't have a favorite piece. I know I'm copping out and not answering your question, but I don't have a favorite piece of equipment. To me as a coach, they're all just tools. Some of them annoy me more than others do. I use WKO for more advanced analytics, but it annoys the hell out of me. But I use it. It is a good tool, but it annoys me. If I had to pick something at the moment that's my sort of favorite go-to at the moment, I like stride power meters for running. I find the information that we're getting from them really useful. Sure, I understand some of the mechanical and the engineering limitations of it and things like that, but it is actually, I think it's quite an exciting tool, and I'm recommending a lot of my athletes use it, and we're getting some really good information back from it, and it is sensitive enough when you use it in the right way to get good quality feedback and track changes and things.
Yep. And finally, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Organization and the planning side of things, when you put that question to me and said I was going to have to answer that one, I had to think long and hard about that. And I think it is the planning side of things, being able to see the big picture and pull it together for athletes and organize things.
Yeah. And where can listeners learn more about you and your coaching business, website, social media, and so on?
So we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram as IntelliTri, IntelliTri, Intelligent Triathlon Training. Or you can go to itt.world, which is our new website. So there's more information about me and what we do on there.
Perfect. And I'll link to that in the show notes as well.
Magic. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark, for coming on and sharing your knowledge. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. We will have links to Mark's website, social media, and also a link to the training category archive of that triathlon show, where you can find plenty of training talks of a similar format to this with various coaches who have been on the podcast over the years. On Thursday, we have another Q&A episode coming out as usual, and next Monday, I interview Professor John Hawley on some incredibly fascinating topics, including musculoskeletal adaptations to endurance training, the train low strategy, training with low carbohydrate, and training for muscle fiber type adaptations, and the difference between fast twitch and slow twitch fibers, and how that affects your training and adaptations. So stay subscribed to the podcast if you aren't already. There's a lot of great content coming out in the next few weeks that you don't want to miss, including the Monday interview with John Hawley, which was really a fascinating interview. If you're looking for training plans or coaching services, be sure to check out what we have to offer on scientifictriathlon.com. We have tons of information there. And for any further information, feel free to email me, michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And finally, thank you to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and take their free online sweat test and get 15% off your order with the promo code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.